I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network with all things political coming up. On Friday, Donald Trump was inaugurated as the 45th president of the United States. We'll examine his inaugural address, his vision of what America is now, and what he would like it to be. On Saturday, there were massive protests against the president in Washington, all over the country, and really the world. Does that translate into some kind of political movement? And if so, what kind of movement? There was the president's appearance before the CIA, to which he, CBS is confirming this news now, brought supporters of his who filled the first three rows and cheered when the president spoke. The president seemed very concerned about the size of the crowd at his inauguration, and so was his press secretary, who is conducting another press conference at this very moment. On Saturday, he said, "This was the largest audience to ever witness the inauguration, period." Both in person and around the globe. Today, the president took executive action on formally withdrawing from the Trans-Pacific Partnership, implementing a federal employee hiring freeze, and reinstating a policy regarding foreign aid and also abortion funding. And there is some news. We're trying to track down a little bit more about this. It's been on Twitter, actually, in the last half hour or so, that there are joint Russian-U.S. flights over Syria. So we're trying to find out more about that, and maybe more will be said about that during the press conference. Joining us this hour to talk about all of this, what a busy all things political we have, is Professor Charles Lipson. He's a professor of political science at the University of Chicago, a contributor to Real Clear Politics, founder and writer for the political blog ZipDialogue.com. Our phone number for you to join this conversation is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@WPR.org. Facebook is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Professor Lipson, Charles, thanks so much for being with us. Hi.
Hey, it's great to be back with you, Kathleen.
Nice to have you here. I don't think I've ever watched so much television as I did over the weekend. I just felt like I had seen hour after hour after hour after hour. It was fascinating, but it was a lot of TV. Let's start with the inaugural address and with this presidency. Never has the oath been administered to a president who's never served either in public office or as a general in the military. Is that a good thing for America to have somebody who's just brand new to the whole thing?
It was one of his major selling points, I think, in the election. Was that he was such an outsider. And I thought that that was the main theme of the address. The address was both to the people in front of him, which weren't quite as many as he said, but to a large crowd. But I thought the main theme of that address was as much to the people behind him, and that was there's a new sheriff in town, or to switch metaphors, I thought it was a speech that said, I'm a bulldozer. I'm coming in here to do things. I'm going to do them differently. And to the crowd that had elected him, and he was saying, I will not be changed by Washington. I am not going to change. And I thought that throughout the weekend, with a series of what most of us would consider missteps, he was in effect sending the same message to the people who voted him into office.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk. I know that you've written about John Lewis, who refused to attend the inaugural, and there were quite a few members of Congress who did the same. You believe that that was not a good decision on the part of Congressman Lewis. Why?
I think that the first of all, I have tremendous respect for Congressman Lewis, and I'm not impugning his motives. But let me just say that I thought it was a mistake for the following reason. There are two aspects to the inauguration. One is the solemn oath of office, which switches peacefully from one president and vice president to another. And then there's the celebratory aspect, the parade, the balls, all of that. I gave tremendous credit to Hillary Clinton for what must have been the most painful public event of her life, which was attending that transfer of power. That must have been excruciating. But it is such a hard-won triumph for America that we switch power peacefully. And we've now had three elections in a row in which there have been fairly strong claims made by people that the new president was not legitimately taking office. We know that this happened after Bush v. Gore in 2000. In fact, I thought the most impressive thing there was that there weren't riots. There was a genuine claim that the wrong person was taking office, but I thought the fact that people acknowledged it was very important. And then Trump himself claiming that President Obama wasn't legitimately in office because he wasn't born in the United States and therefore wasn't eligible to be president. So I'm concerned about things that I think shake the very foundations of the peaceful transfer of power. Mm-hmm.
And yet you have a rather extraordinary thing happening, Charles, and that's that what's going on with Russia and the Trump campaign, what's going on with the investigations, the Senate Intelligence Committee, what the CIA is investigating, the FBI is investigating, and John Lewis appeared to have come from a briefing with classified information, which we don't know what he heard after he made that, before he had made that statement. Isn't that unusual? Isn't this whole entering office under this kind of cloud somewhat unusual and perhaps disturbing?
Yes, I'm not trying to say that there was not a reason why Congressman Lewis did that. I would say that the people who were on those committees and chairs and so forth of those committees all attended. So he didn't hear things that stopped other people from attending the inauguration. I'm saying that the threshold, he publicly accused the president of not being legitimately elected. Didn't say that there are questions, and I find that troubling. I'm attending, but I think we need to continue looking into this. He didn't phrase it like that. Mm-hmm. He gave a flat answer, and that was a concern to me. We're past that now, but I must say there were people. You could take a phrase like, not my president, and that can be perfectly legitimate protest. Most of the people who were marching in the women's marches the next day and so forth were protesting the person, his policies. They find them offensive. They find them policies they can't agree with versus stepping over a line which says, by not my president, I mean not that I disagree with him, but that he is not in office legitimately.
Mm-hmm. He's off to, he's having a whirlwind of days of meetings. I was listening to the press conference. He met with an incredible number of business leaders today. This afternoon, he's meeting with union leaders. He's meeting with other people tonight. He's just off to, and I guess he really has to, right? He has to deliver on some of his major promises and really be seen as a president who's working feverishly.
I think that that's exactly right. I don't think, and you could tell this going back to your question about the inaugural address, I don't think he's going to win people over by playing nice. I think that his success, if he has it as president, will come from people thinking there's higher employment, there's less danger in the streets. We have better health care, not worse. In other words, real outcomes. I'm not saying that he's going to achieve them. I'm saying that only if he achieves them will he be successful. And I think he knows that he will be judged by those markers, and particularly on big promises, immigration, health care, taxes, regulation, and maybe some foreign issues as well, depending upon what comes up. But I think that those are the main issues.
Mm-hmm. Let's hear just a portion of the inaugural address and tell me what is striking to you. It was 18 minutes long, so this is just a piece of it. But for those who missed it, you'll get a flavor of what the 45th president said on Friday of last week. Here he is.
What truly matters is not which party controls our government, but whether our government is controlled by the people. January 20th, 2017 will be remembered as the day the people became the rulers of this nation again. The forgotten men and women of our country will be forgotten no longer. For too many of our citizens, a different reality exists. Mothers and children trapped in poverty in our inner cities. Rusted out factories scattered like tombstones across the landscape of our nation. An education system flush with cash, but which leaves our young and beautiful students deprived of all knowledge. And the crime and the gangs and the drugs that have stolen too many lives and robbed our country of so much unrealized potential. This American carnage stops right here and stops right now.
Let's start with the first part of this, where he talked about it's not which party is in control. It is controlled by the people. The people will become the rulers. This is very unusual for a president to use this kind of language. And I would imagine there were a few Republicans who may have been a little bit concerned about the language. What is he? He's not really a Republican. What is he? He's a populist? He's an independent?
You really nailed it, Kathleen. He defeated both parties in
a
way.
Yes, he did. Yeah.
He defeated the two greatest political dynasties of the last 30 years, the Bushes and the Clintons. He owes relatively little to the Republican Party, with the exception of your own state. I mean, it was really striking how the organization that was put together in Wisconsin, really around the Scott Walker recalls and reelection, came over and helped him carry that state and with it a contested senatorial election. But I must say, it was a populist speech. And it was a speech that said, I know there is an angry public out there, and I am not forgetting that. I am going to be your voice. So it was populist, it was nationalist, and it was not a speech of outreach to people who were in the middle. It didn't say, I know that most people who voted did not vote for me. They voted for Hillary Clinton. That was not what the speech was about.
Mm-hmm. Then he always does this strange thing, and so many people have made much of the fact that he's an insecure man, that he needs constant reassurance about how many people like him or love him. This weird thing that he did at the CIA was, you know, of all places, when he's got a rocky relationship with the CIA to begin with. He's under investigation. He had this intelligence dossier that was given to him by the CIA. And he goes there and a lot of news organizations are confirming today that the first three rows of that hearing were filled with people he asked to be there, not members of the CIA, his supporters. And then he starts talking about how big the crowd is, how many people heard him, a million people, a million and a half, all the way to the monument, which wasn't true. Why in the world does he find it necessary to revert to that so often, Charles?
My wife is the psychologist in our family.
What does she say then?
but I will say that my willingness to say, my Lord, what a political mistake, has been tempered by the fact that I have said that so often about things that he has done, and he's gotten past them.
Yes,
who would have thought that you could say what he did about John McCain to really early in the campaign, that you could get past that incredible tape on the bus in which he is admitting to what most of us would consider in a sexual assault. Maybe mm-hmm. it's braggadocio, but you hear it in his own words, and you think, how could he politically survive this? And yet, he not only survives it, he thrives. So it seemed to me to be the wrong place and the wrong time. And then that briefing by Sean Spicer, in which he comes in, and it's all about what to me is a minor thing, is strange. But I will say this: he has served notice time and time again that if you cross him, you will pay a price, and that has an obvious downside, which we're talking about, but it remains to be seen whether it will help him get his programs through Congress and whether it will have an effect on America's international rivals.
Mm-hmm. Well, the following day, I must say I was amazed by the number of people who were marching, not just in this country, but all over the world. And it didn't seem as though it was an incredibly well-organized kind of march. It started with something on Twitter, and all of a sudden you had these massive demonstrations that you couldn't look askance at. He must be told, and I'm sure he's been told, how many people showed up the day after the inauguration to express their anger that he's the president. What does he do with all that? And were you surprised by the turnout?
I was surprised, although living in Hyde Park neighborhood of Chicago, it's like living in Madison or Ann Arbor or other communities where President Trump received very few votes, lots of opposition. There were signs supporting Hillary Clinton that remained up for more than a month after she had been defeated. The most impressive thing that I saw about the march was actually a picture that was posted from Lubbock, Texas, of all places, which had been voted the most conservative town in the United States, and where there was a substantial women's march. So I thought that it was really striking. Again, I think what President Trump will have to do is provide solutions on the ground, not verbal outreach. He has, in fact, proved that he is not interested in verbal outreach. And he's not interested in appointing a cabinet that looks racially diverse or has this demographic characteristic or that demographic characteristic. What he wants, what he will be judged, and what I think he wants to be judged on, is the basis of results.
Mm-hmm. We're going to welcome phone calls as we talk about the last 3 days and more than the last 3 days, what's going on today as well. It's All Things Political you're listening to here on the Ideas Network. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Professor Charles Lipson is our guest, political science professor at the University of Chicago. He writes regularly for his blog, Zip Dialogue, and he is the author of several books, including Reliable Partners, How Democracies Have Made a Separate Peace. Our Facebook page, where in case our lines are really crowded, you'd like to get through and write a message on Facebook, that would be just fine. And it's the Kathleen Dent Show. We're going to hear just a couple, just to catch up on what's been going on. This is Donald Trump. We were talking about him at the CIA, a little bit of what he said there, followed by a little bit of what Gloria Steinem said at the Women's March on Washington.
I want to just let you know, I am so behind you, and I know maybe sometimes you haven't gotten the backing that you've wanted, and you're going to get so much backing. Maybe you're going to say, please don't give us so much backing. Mr. President, please, we don't need that much backing.
Because this is the upside of the downside. This is an outpouring of energy and true democracy like I have never seen in my very long life. It is wide in age, it is deep in diversity, and remember, the Constitution does not begin with I, the President, it begins with we, the people.
And before we go to the many phone calls, I just want to flush this story out with you for a moment because it's an indication of something strange. I don't quite get this. I saw this on Twitter about a half hour ago, and now we're getting this report. U.S. officials are denying Russian claims of U.S. and Russian cooperation against the Islamic State group. A state-owned Russian outlet made the claim early Monday, suggesting that the U.S.-led coalition battling ISIS had shared intelligence about the militant group's positions with the Russian Defense Ministry. Hours later, the Associated Press reported the ministry saying Russian planes were flying alongside those of the coalition. A coalition spokesperson said, it's rubbish, it's propaganda. What do you make of that?
I take the Americans' word and not the Russians. The Russians have been playing a very dangerous game here. Interfering. What they did in the election goes beyond normal spy. When you spy, you collect information. They engaged in a disinformation campaign. And I recommended in a piece that I had published several weeks ago that there be a very serious bipartisan commission like the 9/11 commission that worked behind the scenes to find out what really happened, but equally important to ensure that it never happens again. The Russians are almost certainly playing a big role in the forthcoming European elections. They would like to toss out a number of the European leaders who support NATO. They'd like to support a number of the far-right leaders who actually would withdraw from NATO. So this is part of a deep game that Putin is playing, and it's a game that deeply interferes with our democratic processes.
Well, it's interesting the AP picked up on that story, too, isn't it?
As you reported, and I didn't see the AP story, as you reported, they were saying that this was reported by a Russian agency, and I find that that sort of thing to be a bit dicey. It's unclear whether you would want to report it without being able to say whether it's true or not. This is what happened with this BuzzFeed story as well. It was when CNN picked it up and put it out that said, oh, somebody else is reporting this, that it gained a lot of currency. A lot of major news organizations had had it before that. Nobody had been able to confirm it. Nobody has been able to confirm it yet. So the fact that CNN put it out by saying, oh, gee, it's on another channel, kind of opened the floodgates, and I thought it was quite unfortunate.
Let's go to phone calls. Lynn in Eau Claire. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen, and hello to your guest. Very important topic today. I'm concerned that we progressives have lost our voice in Madison. We have lost our voice in Washington, and our voices have been replaced by a kind of a base rambling that just panders to people's fears and wishes rather than anything that involves critical thinking. I am seeing that now happening here on a local level where our voices are trying to be quelled. How do we prevent that from happening all the way through our system?
Well, and the second part of the question, which I'll add to it, if you don't mind, Lynn, is what has happened to the Democratic Party and how do they recuperate from pretty big losses, Charles?
This is a really important and interesting question. And I think that the particular problem that the Democratic Party faces is what kind of a new voice it's going to find. What happens when you lose as many offices as the Democrats have over the Obama presidency? They've lost so many state houses. They've lost so many local offices. They've lost so many senatorial bids and the like, is that the people who are left come from the most secure elements of the Democratic base. They come from university towns, from the coastal California, from majority-minority districts, and the like. And the people the people and the policies that they will put forward may not carry well beyond those. And you're seeing that kind of a debate now over who will lead the Democratic National Committee. I mean, this debate over Keith Ellison is a microcosm. I think that that was the genius of Bill Clinton in his first campaign. He brought the party back to a broad national party. And then when he lost 2 years later, he tacked toward what he thought was a winning coalition. In his case, it was toward the center, and that kept him in power, and it kept the Democratic Party in power. That's the problem. The problem that your guest raised is the question facing the Democrats, and it will be answered by a rump portion of the population, the most secure elements of the Democratic Party base.
Kevin in Cramden, hi.
Well, yeah, I'd just like to remind everyone of the just dropping hypocrisy of the people now in charge. All the things that Trump said to the campaign, all the nasty things he said about all the different people, and yet now all these we're all supposed to gather around the campfire and sing Kumbaya and I'll give him a chance and so on and so forth. And I mean, let's get real. That's just crazy. And also, is there anything that will be just so un-American and egregious that Trump and his fellow travelers will do that will finally wake up the American people as to what they're really all about?
Charles.
Well, I mean, he was elected the president of the United States. He can only get things through the Congress if the Congress thinks that their own reelection, their own voting base, thinks that they're popular enough. There are many people out in the country who agree with your caller in that they are not just opposed, they're deeply opposed and angry about the election. But I think that the notion that may have been in the tone of the question, certainly is in the tone of many other people, is that this person is not legitimately in office. It is both a mistake politically and damaging to the country. You can be opposed to him. You can be opposed to what he's doing. You can be opposed to his party. But it's a bad thing for our country. It's a bad thing for our country to challenge the legitimacy of his electoral win. He won through the constitutional procedures that we have, even though he didn't win a majority of the popular vote. Hillary Clinton beat him significantly by something like 3 million votes.
Mm-hmm. But he's also entering, I mean, it's almost understandable because he's entering this office with, as we previously said, these investigations about Russia and possible collusion with his campaign. We had a suit filed today, this morning, charging him with violating the Foreign Emoluments Clause. He's saying it's totally without merit, but there are some pretty smart people who have brought this forward who said that this is the case. We've got a lot of clouds hanging over him, a lot of ethical clouds hanging over him, which makes it difficult for everybody to gather together and say, you know, we're going to give you a chance. Don't you think?
I wasn't arguing that people should say we're going to give you a chance. I wasn't arguing that. And I do agree with you that there are a number of these questions. I would say that the lawsuit is part of a strategy of trying to tie him up in sort of legal tangles, just as we saw happen to President Bill Clinton with a number of those kinds of things. We saw a lot of that happen with President Obama, with people challenging his citizenship and the like. People have a right to file lawsuits, but and I think the big question on a lot of this is whether or not Charles Schumer's decision in the Senate to try to slow walk all of the he listed eight nominees, but there will be a ninth because whoever Trump nominates for the Supreme Court will also get just a whole lot of opposition from the Democratic Party. If that strategy is good for the Democrats, you can argue one way or the other about what it's good for the country, but we have a president who has only two members of his cabinet who are now in seated. So we have a federal government that is essentially in department after department without its permanent leadership. Partly because Trump's people were slow with their paperwork,
right.
But it was also a deliberate decision by the Democrats to see if they could slow this down.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that Donald Trump is going to be forced to give us his tax returns?
There's a lot of pressure on, and I think that the pressure is totally legitimate. The reason people want to see his tax returns is that they want to understand the nature of the financial conflicts of interest. The simple purient elements, let's see how much he's really worth, has he been exaggerating, and so forth. I don't think that that's a public interest that is worthy of being met. But I do think that that the nature of who he owes money to, those kinds of things, where he has financial stakes, those are legitimate public interest. The pressure will remain on him to get that out. When people don't release things, there's a reason. And President Obama, there were a number of things he never released, fought against releasing, has not released now. There's a reason for it. It may not be the reason the rest of us think about, but if Trump won't release it, there's a reason.
I'm sure that's true. Ed, go ahead.
Well, before we forget about Inauguration Day, I just want to say what a wonderful day it was for us protesters who traveled, in my case, the 793 miles from Milwaukee to Washington, D.C. We were there in front of the Dubliner for Morning Joe. A lot of us got in. We were there taking the abuse from the Trump people on the Mall. We were there with the police riot where they started throwing canisters of spray against us, and it was one of those police that lobbed the canister into that limousine that you saw on fire. And then we were at the parade route. We had 250,000 protesters all across Washington, D.C. on Friday. And I think that's very significant. And we showed up. And I think we took this message. We were sort of the New Haven play before it gets to Broadway on Saturday. We were the pre-act for the Saturday march. But I don't want to forget about what happened on Friday.
Charles.
Well, I think that what we're seeing is that unlike so many elections where the country comes together after a victor has been decided and sworn into office, there's at least a brief period of honeymoon. This just is not happening here. And you can see it in another way in the United States Senate. When you mark out how conservative or liberal members are and you look at the Republicans, the most liberal Republican overlaps with only one conservative Democrat. That is the Susan Collins of Maine and Joe Manchin of West Virginia of opposite parties have fairly similar voting records. But other than that, the two parties are completely separated. One party much more conservative, one party much more liberal. You're seeing that on the streets of Washington that our caller just mentioned. You're seeing it on the streets the next day of Chicago and New York, and as I said, even Lubbock, Texas. So we have a deeply divided country. It's not going to come together in a kumbaya moment. It's not going to come together over things that Donald Trump says. In fact, what he says seems to divide people more. I think the question is whether he's going to be able to deliver on some of the promises, especially the economic promises, some of the other promises like immigration and perhaps taxes may divide the country even more.
And where would you, if you had to describe the American populace, would you say that we are, Charles, center right, center left? Where are we?
The usual statement about the country is that it's slightly center right, but I don't know enough about the texture of public opinion. I do think that the country is not terribly ideological. I think that the country is more pragmatic, and that I think most voters are pragmatic. And I would say that the country has been angry and disappointed for a number of years. If you go back to President Obama's hope and change slogan, what it really was saying was it put a smiley face emoticon on throw the bums out. We've had quite a few throw the bums out elections, and the voting population keeps saying the bums are still in there. Now, part of it, and you've heard it from your callers, is that their notion of who the bums are is different from another group's notion of who the bums are. But you've had elections like this in Wisconsin. You've got a deeply divided state. And I think that there's just a lot of anger. There's a lot of sense that the other party no longer represents me, that nobody's reaching across the aisle. And I think that's right.
More phone calls momentarily. You're listening to All Things Political, which you always hear Mondays at 1 o'clock. And our guest is Professor Charles Lipson. He's a professor of political science at the University of Chicago. He contributes to Real Clear Politics and is founder and writer for the political blog ZipDialogue.com. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk at WPR.org. Facebook is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Some of the weekend, a lot of the press over the weekend was the dispute about the size of the crowds at the inaugural and how they compared to other inaugural crowds. We were talking about that earlier with Charles, so let's hear just a little bit of what the new press secretary, Sean Spicer, said, and later what Kellyanne Conway, senior advisor to the president, had to say about the same subject. And then we'll be back to you.
Secondly, photographs of the inaugural proceedings were intentionally framed in a way, in one particular tweet, to minimize the enormous support that had gathered on the National Mall. This was the first time in our nation's history that floor coverings have been used to protect the grass in the mall. That had the effect of highlighting any areas where people were not standing, while in years past, the grass eliminated this visual. This is also the first time that fencing and magnetometers went as far back on the wall, preventing hundreds of thousands of people from being able to access the mall as quickly as they had in inaugurations past.
And you did not answer the question.
You did not answer the question
of why the president asked the White House press secretary to come out in front of the podium for the first time and utter a falsehood. Why did he do that? It undermines the credibility of the entire White House press office
on
day one.
Don't be so overly dramatic about it, Chuck. You're saying it's a falsehood, and they're giving Sean Spicer, our press secretary, gave alternative facts to that. But the point remains.
Alternative facts?
Oh, this is going to be continuing, isn't it, this relationship between the White House and the press and the American public and the press as well. You kind of want to have an end put to this because I think that people would like to know the truth about situations. So how do we accomplish that, Charles?
I just found that whole thing bizarre.
It was.
And nothing more bizarre than Sean Spicer's coming out and attacking people for what seemed to be an accurate reporting. And not saying people can differ on this, but saying you guys are lying, you're doing it deliberately. The only rationale I can think for it, I can think of two. One is a shot across the bow. If you don't give us more favorable reporting, you will pay a price. And we've seen that before. We've seen people not allowed into briefings and all the rest. But I think that the other is the fact that the media is really unpopular. Unpopular. Mainstream media is unpopular to the degree that used car salesmen are unpopular, the way that Congress is unpopular. So when you attack the news media, it's not as if people just rally around them. But it's a dangerous thing because we really depend. I can't be in the briefing room. I depend upon people asking questions, and I depend upon an answer. If they don't have the answer, I want them to say, "We'll get back to you tomorrow on that." I don't want to hear them giving alternative facts. I don't want to hear them. I expect spin, but there's a limit to what spin is. So I think that this is very troubling, and I think that it would be equally troubling if what happens is that the press changes what it does to become more and more adversarial. And I think that there was a lot of criticism of the press, certainly from conservatives, that it was too fawning over the Obama White House, certainly for the first several years. If it becomes an adversarial, a hostile press, not in the normal sense of holding any president to account, but becoming, in effect, an editorially hostile press to Trump, that will be bad for the press, but worst of all, it'll be bad for the rest of us, the citizens of the country.
Let's go to Samantha in Madison. Hi, Samantha.
Hi. So my comment is this, that this election cycle has really shown the true colors of the for-profit media and how it got played by Trump and his people. They ran after the Twitter balls he tossed out instead of reporting on substance. They reported on Hillary Clinton's emails, which had no evidence of wrongdoing, while doing very little reporting on the numerous incidents of Trump's wrongdoing. Their efforts to be fair just laid out how unfair they have been and held Mrs. Clinton to a higher standard than Trump. They let him tell lies for months and months before even beginning to call them out, and now they will be played again. Trump will continue to control the media and what gets reported by controlling who has access to him. And the media will again be chasing the balls he throws out to them, like how many people really attended his inauguration. That was a ball he threw out, and the media just followed it. And we, the public, will once again not have true and fair and honest coverage. The media will need to have an awakening along with the rest of this country.
Well, I think there was significant pushback from the media, at least you heard in that clip from Chuck Todd, but others as well. But you don't want the whole substance of our political discourse to be that kind of substance. You know, there are facts are facts. You don't want to spend time debating that. Charles, what do you think?
Well, yes. Well, I think what you've heard from caller after caller is a deep sense of revulsion about the new president, about what the reporting looks like. I think that that this just is a reflection of something that we all know, that there's not only a deeply divided country, but that they're deeply divided over a new presidency. I will say that what we haven't gotten to so far is that Trump himself has laid out a very ambitious agenda for his presidency. He's going to change U.S. immigration policy, working with the Congress if he can. He intends a really major change in the U.S. tax code, especially in taxing corporations. He intends to change Obamacare. I think that what's left of Obamacare is that there has been real movement toward popular support for an insurance-based system of health care. That's and that a number of the provisions of Obamacare are popular, even if the overall program never really won overall popularity. It just edged above 50% in the last few months. But there are a number of parts of the program that are popular. There's a real question of how you pay for those parts while jettisoning the other parts which were unpopular and which paid for it.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I think that Trump has a massive deregulation program in prospect. In fact, this will have a tremendous impact on small businesses in particular, which find it very difficult to deal with regulations. Bigger businesses have economies of scale in dealing with them. So I think that in concentrating on the politics of the moment, we should not overlook the fact that these are big goals that he has laid out. Those themselves will be divisive beyond his personality, but it's an ambitious, consequential agenda.
Mm-hmm. And if he can link with, I mean, today Bernie Sanders said, I'm going to support him on this Trans-Pacific Partnership, withdrawing from it. You know, I'll work with him on that. If there are jobs to be brought back, he can see some left-of-center Democrats, I'm sure, who may give him support on some of those issues.
And on the infrastructure program as
yes.
well. But I wouldn't overdo it. I think that you're going to just see deep conflicts. You're going to talk about them in the next hour. I think less so over Mnuchin than over DeVos.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that over the EPA nominee, Scott Pruitt.
Right.
You will see similar things, maybe over Puster at Labor. There are deep divisions about what kind of programs the United States should have on environmental regulation, on public schooling, on the issues of race and the police. These have been these are not new. It's not as if Trump pulled them out of the air. These have been problems for a long time, and he's offering a kind of bold, different kind of proposed solutions. There's a question as to whether he'll get them through. And remember, I said, in effect, he defeated the Republican Party, too.
Right.
So we shouldn't just think that it's going to be him against Chuck Schumer.
Right.
There's real questions about how he'll deal with the
with
Republicans in office.
Charles,
as well.
Thank you ever so much. Thanks for the
thank
hour.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Charles Lipson, our guest, professor of political science at the University of Chicago. He contributes to Real Clear Politics and is founder and writer for ZipDialogue.com. Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing this hour, and to Colleen Duvall for on-air production here in Milwaukee. Go to our Facebook page. We had tons of phone calls. Couldn't get to all of you, the Kathleen Dunn Show. So at least we can read what your thoughts are. That would be good.